And welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio show and podcast. I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith. Nice to be here. And just as a reminder, we are on at Red State Talk Radio every weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, on both channels. And we also have a podcast. The podcast can be found on our website, throttleupradio.com, and also on iTunes. So we are in the midst of, or on a continuing quest here. We've been doing a lot of these special editions, and this is a special edition as well. And what we're trying to deal with here is we're trying to take a look at this whole issue of the truth, if you will. It comes from, I guess you could say it comes from two sources, but I like to think of it is actually emanating from the foundation skill sets that we all ought to have in possession. We ought to be in possession of the foundational skill set, which is critical thinking. And of course, that's what this whole show is all about, how to think critically in the real world. We are application oriented. We try to deal with the real world. We try to deal with things that are important to us as members of a modern industrial society, as well as members of the country that we live in, which is the United States of America. And this is a great country. There are others as well, of course, but this is a great country. And it's great because the people are great. That's what makes it great. Anyway, that's the foundational course, critical thinking. And emanating from that is a number of related disciplines, if you will, or related modes of thinking. And we have covered a great deal of those in the course of this radio show. Right now we're dealing with this whole issue of the theory of knowledge and the theory of truth. Particularly, we're looking at the theory of truth, which is a subset of the theory of knowledge, which of course emanates from critical thinking. Okay, that's how the that's how the thread goes. That's how the trajectory goes. And with respect to that, we are dealing right now with, and have been for quite some time, we're dealing with the truth algorithm. Is there such a thing as a truth algorithm? We're going to build one, right? We do things that are not necessarily common. We are outside the box thinkers, and we engage our thinking process in areas that are relatively new. They are often brand new, so we go outside the box, and we're not afraid to do that. We are independent thinkers. We think for ourselves. That's the key. Am I going to think for myself, or am I going to follow the crowd? Now, if you like to follow the crowd, this is probably not a good place for you to be listening to this show. But if you don't like to follow the crowd, if you are, in fact, an independent thinker, a critical thinker, then this is the place for you. You've found a home, and we will be providing you with things that are intellectually new, hopefully stimulating, and provide you with answers to some critical questions and help all of us so that we can succeed and we can achieve success for ourselves and others. And what I just said is very, very important. We're not doing this selfishly. We are not being self-indulgent. We are doing this to help ourselves as well as to be helpful to others. That's the key. Okay, so we're going to press on with this thing. We're in the midst of a whole discussion. We talked about it last week. So this is a continuation of our show last week, which we addressed ourselves to this whole issue of the COVID-19 vaccines, the information that is being given to us by the Center for Disease Control. We covered that, and we uncovered, if you remember from last week's show, we uncovered some serious problems with the logical structure and the coherency of the advice that is being given or put forward, the information that is being given or put forward by the Center of Disease Control. We are going to look at this thing a bit differently, which we have been doing for ever since we started this special edition, which we call the Truth Algorithm. Our perspective, as we embrace this whole idea of that there is, in fact, an algorithmic process by which we can close in on the truth, by which we can, in some effective way, determine whether or not something that is claimed to be true is in fact true. And this is the first decision point that we come to. If we are being given something, some piece of information that is claimed to be true, how do we know, how do we determine if in fact it is true? Just because it is claimed to be true does not necessarily mean that it is true. It could be false. It could be a lie. And so how do we determine analytically if something that is given to us that is claimed to be true is in fact true? So we're looking at the claim as well as the information. We're looking at it from the perspective that whether or not this claim that it is true is in fact the truth. Okay. Now we're going to jump right into something here. We're in the midst of a discussion of the claims that are being put forward by the Center for Disease Control with respect to the COVID-19 vaccine. Okay. There are a lot of claims out there. A lot of things that people want us to believe, but let's go ahead and examine them from the perspective of the truth algorithm. Now, what is the truth algorithm? Now, let me quickly explain that. Now, the first thing that I can say is the truth algorithm is a work in progress. We are working through that together. So if you listen to the show over the long term, you can see that we're working through that together. I'm going to give you a metaphor now to help us understand exactly what is the truth algorithm, and then we're going to get right into this whole issue of the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccine and whether or not information that we are being given is in fact true or it is not necessarily true. It is misleading us into believing something that some group of people want us to believe in that is not necessarily the truth. It is a deception. Okay. The metaphor is this. The metaphor is golf. Okay. Think of it. The truth algorithm represents a golf game. Okay. As we engage in playing the game of golf, there are certain parameters by which we conduct this exercise or this game. Okay. Now let's assume for the moment that our life is like a game of golf, and we could choose to our life is like this particular a fairway. It could be hole number one. It could be number nine. It could be number 14. It could be number 18. It doesn't really matter. What matters here is we have chosen to play either a three par, four par, or a five par fairway. Okay. Nevertheless, we are going. That is our game. Okay. So for the especially brave souls out there, let's assume for the moment that we're playing a five par hole. Okay. We have direction and we have distance. We are trying to achieve excellence, and our target is the hole in the pin on the green. Okay. Now, as we play this game, we have to consider certain things that will affect playing performance. We have to consider the lay of the land. We have to consider certain critical aspects of the environment and the location and other things. And it all has to fit into some kind of a picture, some kind of a big picture, some kind of a framework. And let's go to the green. All right. If we are putting on the green, we need to take into account certain realities that the green presents to us. What are the realities? It could be the undulation of the green. It could be whether or not the green is level or whether or not the green is on a slanted surface, and what is the degree by which the green is not level. Is it undulate and stuff like that? And so those are the realities that we have to consider as we approach our ball, getting ready to putt, and we are on the green. All right, well, the same is true here, or the same kind of thing is relevant when we are trying to determine whether or not something is true. We have to look at the surroundings. We have to look at the big picture. We have to look at other things that have some relationship to the truth. What are the other things? Is it logical and is it coherent and is it congruent? Okay, those three terms that I've just thrown out there are similar, and you can write down your own definitions. I have done that myself, but I want also the listeners to engage their minds, their abilities to think critically, and to consider, okay, what are the other things that are related to this claim? Are there other things out there that we should consider as we are examining the veracity or the viability or the accuracy of this claim? What is the claim? The claim, of course, is that this, whatever this piece of information is in fact true. Okay, our job here is first and foremost to go into that decision tree. And the decision tree has three branches right up front, as part of our algorithm, by the way, where the first step in our algorithm is this decision branch. It is the claim is true. It's verified to be true. The claim is not true. It is verified to be false. Or the third branch is that we are uncertain. We just don't. If, in fact, we are uncertain, then we proceed to the next phase of the algorithm. If we are certain about what we have just said, then we don't need to go any further. If we are certain that it is true, then we stop there. If we are certain that it is not true, then we stop there. But if we are uncertain, then we proceed to the next branch, which we will get into in the future programs. Throttle up shows and podcasts in the future. Right now, we are going to look at something which is critically important. And I'm going to be playing this audio. This audio, by the way, is from a Indiana doctor and has gone viral. It's all over the place. I'm going to play it at least once. And we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it with respect to what is true. What information have we been given out there that we just should not believe on face value? We should be skeptical. As critical thinkers, we are always skeptical. Be skeptical. Is one of the five agreements, by the way. And we are, in fact, going to be skeptical, and we want to look at things from a critical thinking standpoint. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and play this audio clip. I think it's about six. Is it 6 minutes long? Yeah, I'm talking to my audio engineer. And she's a great help to me every week. Okay, so let's play this. This is really important stuff, but let's look at it also from the perspective of this truth algorithm. What exactly is the truth out there concerning the coronavirus vaccine? Okay, here we go.
Dr. Dan Stock, 5777 West 700 North, McCordsville, Indiana. To address your comment, it's hard to believe we're 18 months into this and still having a problem. And I would suggest the reason we still have a problem is because we're doing things that are not useful. And we're getting our sources of information from the Indiana State Board of Health and the CDC, who actually don't bother to read science before they do this. I'm actually a functional family medicine physician. That means I am specially trained in immunology and inflammation regulation. And everything being recommended by the CDC and the State Board of Health is actually contrary to all the rules of science. So things you should know about coronavirus and all other respiratory viruses, they are spread by aerosol particles, which are small enough to go through every mask. By the way, the literature that supports all of that is in a flash drive that we presented to you. It's been given to the secretary. As a matter of fact, it quotes at least three studies sponsored by the NIH to that exact fact, even though the CDC and the NIH have chosen to ignore the very science that they paid to have done. That is why you keep struggling with this, is because you cannot make these viruses go away. The natural history of all respiratory viruses is that they circulate all year long, waiting for the immune system to get sick through the winter or become deranged, as has happened recently with these vaccines, and then they cause symptomatic disease. Because they cannot be filtered out, and they have animal reservoirs, and this is a very important point, no one can make this virus go away. The CDC has managed to convince everybody that we can handle this like we did smallpox, where we could make a virus go away. Smallpox had no animal reservoirs. The only thing it learned to infect was humans. That's why we were able to make that virus go away. That will not happen with this any more than it will with influenza, the common cold, respiratory syncytial virus, adenoviral respiratory syndromes, or anything else that has animal reservoirs. So the reason you can't do this is because you're trying to do something which has already been tried and can't be done. Equally important is that vaccination changes none of this, especially with this vaccine. And I would hope this board would start asking itself, before it considers taking the advice of the CDC, the NIH, and the State Board of Health, why we are doing things about this that we didn't do for the common cold, influenza, or respiratory syncytial virus. And then ask yourself, why is a vaccine that is supposedly so effective having a breakout in the middle of the summer when respiratory viral syndromes don't do that? And to help you understand that, you need to know the condition that is called antibody-mediated viral enhancement. That is a condition done when vaccines work wrong, as they did in every coronavirus study done in animals on coronaviruses after the SARS outbreak, and done in respiratory syncytial virus, where a vaccine used in a vulnerable individual done the wrong way, which cannot be done right for a respiratory virus which has a very low pathogenicity rate, causes the immune system to actually fight the virus wrong and let the virus become worse than it would with native infection. And that is why you are seeing an outbreak right now. In fact, in that flash drive you're going to have coming to you and in the emails with Six Extra, there will be a study showing that 75% of people who had COVID-19 positive symptom cases in Barnstable, Massachusetts outbreak were fully vaccinated. Therefore, there is no reason for treating any person vaccinated any differently than any person unvaccinated. You should also know that no vaccine, even the ones I support and would give to myself and my children, ever stops infection. In 2014, there was an outbreak of mumps in the National Hockey League. The only people who came down the symptoms were the people who were unvaccinated or unknown vaccine status. Boy, that sounds like a great argument for vaccines. But a question that you should ask yourself, knowing that half of the people who came down with symptomatic disease had no contact with an unvaccinated or unknown vaccine status individual, where did they get the disease? And the answer was from the vaccinated individuals. No vaccine prevents you from getting infection. You get infected, you shed pathogen. This is especially true of viral respiratory pathogens. You just don't get symptomatic from it. So you cannot stop spread. You cannot make these numbers that you've planned on get better by doing any of the things you're doing, because that is the nature of viral respiratory pathogens. And you can't prevent it with a vaccine because they don't do the very thing you're wanting them to do. And you will be chasing this the remainder of your life until you recognize that the Center for Disease Control and the Indiana State Board of Health are giving you very bad scientific guidance. And instead, read the articles that are going to come in the email and are on this flash drive, and listen to the people in this audience here tonight who actually have recognized the advice they are getting from the CDC and the NIH is counterfactual. And that's why you're still fighting this with this vaccine that supposedly was going to make all of this go away, but has suddenly managed to make an outbreak of COVID-19 develop in the middle of the summer when vitamin D levels are at their highest. By the way, the other thing that would be necessary, any vaccine restriction to be considered, is if there were no other treatment available. And I can tell you, having treated over 15 COVID-19 patients, that between active loading with vitamin D, ivermectin, and zinc, that there is not a single person who has come anywhere near the hospital. And we already have studies that show that if you achieve a 25 hydroxy vitamin D level greater than 55, your risk of COVID-19 death will drop down to 1/4 of the population average for the United States. And there are active treatment trials included on that flash drive that show the same is true. So if you were going to discriminate based upon vaccine, you should also discriminate based upon 25 hydroxy vitamin D level, zinc taste test response, and probably previous infection, since there are also studies on that flash drive that show that people who have recovered from COVID-19 infection actually get no benefit from vaccination at all, no reduction in symptoms, no reduction in hospitalization, and suffer 2 to 4 times the rate of side effects if they are subsequently vaccinated. Therefore, the policies that you are basing on are totally counterfactual. I don't blame this board for that, because I know you aren't scientists and you've thought it was reasonable to listen to the CDC, NIH, and the Indiana State Board of Health, but I would encourage that instead you listen to the people out here in this audience and read what's on that data drive. And if anybody here in this board has any questions about anything on that, I will happily come back and sit with you individually if you would like to explain the science behind this. And if you're worried about being sued by somebody because you don't follow the guidance of the CDC and the NIH, I will tell you, have a free pro bono expert testimony at your disposal. I will testify in defense of this board, turning down all these recommendations for free at any time in any court.
Okay. So that's from this Indiana doctor and specialist, and I wrote this down, Dan Stork, I think is his name, Dr. Dan Stork. Okay, now, this fits into my ongoing discussion here. It fits into this important discussion, I believe, which is based upon the truth algorithm. These claims let us consider this information is coming to us wrapped in this package that is representative of all information that is true. All right, so we could say that the package that this information is coming to us says, what you have in this package is, in fact, verifiably true. It is justifiably true. So the claim is that this information is true. Dr. Dan Stork is discussing these truthful aspects of it. He is asserting with quite a bit of credibility, he is asserting the fact that this is bad advice, this is counterfactual, this is inconsistent with known scientific experimentations and results achieved therein. This is information that is the claim actually is false because no benefits are achieved. And he's got a lot of information here that points to the fact that a lot of these claims are hollow. These are hollow claims. They have very little to support them. They're little more than wishful thinking on the part of the, particularly on the part of the CDC and other government health agencies. They are trying to get us to believe something that actually is not true. There is a lot here with respect to the lay of the land in terms of how do viruses behave. Okay. He is the first one that I've seen come forward with this in this coherent way. He is looking at the behavior and the characteristics, the attributes of viruses? How do they behave? Where do they reside? Where do they come from? Why do they erupt into the human sphere of existence? And what can we do based upon the understanding of the actual behavior of viruses? All right, so clarify the actual is one of the things that we discuss in critical thinking all the time. The actual behavior, all right. So a lot of these claims and a lot of this national effort to get everybody vaccinated utilizing an experimental vaccine is running straight up against reality. It is confronting reality. It wants us to believe something that is very likely not true. So the claim is that this information is true is falling apart. We can actually say right up front that the truth claim cannot be supported as part of our algorithm. Is this claim acceptable? The claim which is that this is true. Is this believable? Will we accept it? And the answer is no, we are not going to accept this as true. We reject the claim that it is true. Now, it's either not true or it's uncertain. Okay, so we have the two other branches, but the first branch is that nope, we do not buy into this claim. It is not consistent with what we understand reality to be. It is an affront to reality. It does not exist in the real world simply because it can't. Okay, and that's pretty important, what I just said. Is it possible for this to exist in the real world? And the answer is no, it is not possible because it simply can't, based upon our understanding of the behavior of viruses and the functionality of vaccines. How do vaccines work? How well do they work? And by which functional mechanisms do vaccines actually work? Okay, so we are coming up to the another point that I want to make, and of course we're running out of time again. I apologize for that. We have a lot of information here to discuss as we go forward. But I really want to get this other piece in. It's a 10-minute piece, and it's from the Academy of Ideas. So I want to discuss this. And what is the title? I'm asking my audio engineer. The title of this piece is "Do We Live in a Sick Society?" Okay, now this is all part of this whole aspect of trying to figure out what is the truth. It's part of our truth algorithm, and that's one of the other branches here that we have to encounter. Once we determine that the claim that this information is true, once we determine that that claim is not acceptable, the claim is false, it's a false claim. Okay, once we determine that, then we have to go to the next branch of the algorithm. and that branch is going to ask us some very, very important questions that we must deal with and we must answer. It all centers around this whole aspect of we are living in a human existence, and we're living in a society, and we're living in a community, living in a country. Our society, there are certain norms and there's certain ways that we think. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. Okay, but we are in fact living in a society. Does the society have an influence on the way we think? And the answer is, for most of us, it does. For some of us that are independent thinkers, we really don't care so much. I guess that's a little bit harsh, but we are aware of how society thinks, but we are not inclined to adopt it if we believe there is in fact an alternative way to think that is more productive, or it is more justified based upon our belief and value system. Okay, so sometimes the society is sick. We have to determine whether or not now the society that we are living in, we must determine right now whether our society is healthy or sick. Let us dive right into this right now, and let us think about this very, very carefully and come up with an answer to this question, which is the second branch in our algorithm. Do we live in a sick society? The answer is either yes or no. So let's go. Here we go.
Now, there are times when a whole generation is caught between two ages, two modes of life, with the consequence that it loses all power to understand itself and has no standards, no security, no simple acquiescence. Do we live in an age where normality has become a sickness? Has our society become so corrupt that the more we adapt to it, the less functional we become? In this video, we will explore these questions. What it means to be normal is relative to the society in which we live. Across time and place, and from culture to culture, the standards of normality differ. But while normality is culturally variant, there is an essence to what it means to be normal, and this essence lies with conformity. To be normal is to be a conformist. It is to be guided by the status quo, to accept the dogmas of one's age and to adhere to the dominant value system of one's society. Or as the psychologist Stephen Bartlett wrote, "Psychological normality is the set of typical and socially approved characteristics of affective, cognitive, and behavioral functioning. A set of characteristics derived from the reference group consisting of the majority in a society's population." For much of human history, spurring the norms of one's society was a risky proposition, as it increased the chance of being rejected by one's social group, and so decreased the ability to survive and pass on one's genes. Conformity, in other words, is a trait that was selected for through the process of evolution, and this can help account for the strong pull we feel to be normal. Another factor that makes normality attractive is our tendency, like all biological creatures, to take the path of least resistance. Life is too complicated to improvise novel ways of dealing with all situations, and so most of the time we just do as others do and think as others think. That mankind has this inborn disposition to conform is a good thing. It promotes social cohesion and cooperation, and it allows a society to develop in complex ways that would be impossible were we not a conforming species. But just because conformity helped us survive in times past, and just because a modicum of conformity is needed for a society to function, it does not follow that conformity is always life-enhancing. Instead, the value of conformity is contingent on the conditions of the society in which we live. What is more, conformity must be balanced by a healthy dose of nonconformity, lest a culture is to stagnate. For it is nonconformity which creates the new, exposes the flaws of the old, and helps push a society toward better frontiers. In the West, however, there is a tendency to overvalue conformity and to label, stigmatize, ostracize, and in extreme cases even institutionalize anyone who deviates too far from the accepted standards of normality. Benjamin Rush, the founder of the American Psychiatric Association, epitomized this view with the following statement. Sanity, aptitude to judge things like other men, and regular habits, etc. Insanity, a departure from this. Reflecting on Rush's pronouncement, Stephen Bartlett wrote the following. For Dr. Rush, social conformity is synonymous with mental health, and social nonconformity with mental illness. In the two intervening centuries since Dr. Rush made his diagnostic pronouncements, the standard of mental health set by conformity with the psychological norms of everyday society has remained exempt from serious challenge by mainstream psychiatry and clinical psychology. The problem with Rush's definition of sanity is that it is built on a faulty assumption. It assumes that the norms of a society cannot become corrupted, and that normality cannot be the cause of mental illness. In a flourishing society, Rush's definition of sanity may hold. But when a culture becomes sick and a society corrupted, normality becomes a standard that arrests, inhibits, distorts, handicaps, and delays one's healthy development. Adapting to a sick society produces sickness. Conforming to a mad world produces madness. And in such cases, Rush's definition of sanity is flipped on its head. Sanity becomes a departure from normality, and normality approaches insanity. What is more, associating mental health with conformity overlooks the fact that too much conformity can easily produce an unhealthy psychological and behavioral rigidity that sets the conformist up for great suffering should he or she be destined to live through some sort of major societal upheaval. Or as Carl Jung writes in his book, Psychological Types, the normal man may indeed thrive in the surroundings of his society, but only up to the point where he and his milieu meet with disaster for transgressing the laws of reality and human nature. He will share the general collapse to exactly the same extent as he was adjusted to the previous situation. Adjustment is not adaptation. Adaptation requires far more than merely going along smoothly with the conditions of the moment. It requires observance of laws more universal than the immediate conditions of time and place. The very adjustment of the normal individual is his limitation. At times of social stability, conformity can make life easier, but at times of social instability, the greater our conformity, the more our mind will act like a mirror and reflect the chaos of society back within. For this reason, a social crisis can easily induce a mass identity crisis throughout a population of ardent conformists. Or as the sociologist Gerald Platt explains, the loss of familiar social orders and one's place in them is potentially chaotic. People who can't sustain a biographically achieved sense of personal identity, continuity, feelings of worthiness, self-esteem, membership in a community, and so on, are easily overwhelmed by affective experiences. When these conditions are widespread, the society is undergoing a sense-making crisis. Many people these days, facing the prospect of having to reestablish order and meaning to their lives as our societies change, desire for a return to the status quo. But going back to the way things were, while probably not even possible, would not be beneficial even if it were. For the past paved the way to the present, and as many contrarian thinkers have warned, the West has been in a state of sickness and decline for decades, and normality has been a corrupted standard for just as long. What is different now is that the unremitting might of reality is crushing the illusions that blinded many people from seeing the sickness of modern-day normality, and which kept them believing that conforming to such standards was the safest path to take. But as Aldous Huxley prophetically warned over 60 years ago, the real hopeless victims of mental illness are to be found among those who appear to be most normal. They are normal only in relation to a profoundly abnormal society. Their perfect adjustment to that abnormal society is a measure of their mental sickness. These millions of abnormally normal people, living without a fuss in a society to which, if they were fully human beings, they ought not to be adjusted. That normality does not equal mental health can be seen in the high rates of anxiety disorders, depression, and suicides, and by the widespread abuse of drugs and alcohol. What is more, the mob mentality and groupthink, which has been raging on social media for a decade, and which is now playing out in the streets, is a further sign of the collective insecurity of our age. Helplessness and panic, wrote Jung, lead to group formation, or rather to a clustering together in masses for the sake of gregarious security. But perhaps the simplest way to judge the value of Western normality is to ask the following question. Does the average man or woman come across as a strong individual who is armed with the character traits to face up to the challenges of life? Or to paraphrase the author Richard Weaver, does the typical modern have the look of the hunted? Given the sheep-like reaction to the current crisis, and the ease with which most people can be induced into a state of utter panic and fear, the latter option seems more likely. We are on guard against contagious diseases of the body, wrote Jung, but we are careless when it comes to the even more dangerous collective diseases of the mind. If a collective disease of the mind has spread across much of the world, the only solution for those of us who wish to maintain our sanity is to learn what facilitates human flourishing and to build our lives around such foundations. For while the standards of normality are culturally variable, what produces human flourishing is more constant. We have an abiding nature with roots that stretch far back into our evolutionary history, and as Jung points out, when a living organism is cut off from its roots, it loses a connection with the foundation of its existence and must necessarily perish. And here may lie the fatal flaw of the West's conception of normality. It fails to properly account for the demands of our nature, and one of the glaring ways in which it does this is by providing inadequate outlets for what Friedrich Nietzsche viewed as the most fundamental of our drives, namely our will to power. For while many people are aware of the dictum, absolute power corrupts absolutely, few understand, as the psychologist Rollo May wrote, that the absence of personal power can be equally corruptive. At an individual level, powerlessness leads to envy, victimhood, and an apathy that promotes mental illness. While at a societal level, a population of disempowered men and women paves the way for tyranny. And so, given that a healthy dose of power promotes individual health, while simultaneously diminishing the inequalities of power that corrupt a society, in the next video, we are going to explore the psychology of power. Wherever I found the living, wrote Nietzsche, there I found the will to power.
Okay, so here we have the second branch of the truth algorithm. Now, the second branch, and I know I'm repeating myself, but I think it's okay. The second branch of the truth algorithm is our environment, the society that we are living in. Remember that the golf metaphor, we are actually looking at our environment as we proceed down the fairway. We're looking at the wind direction, we're looking at the sun angle, we're looking at it could be trees along the edge of the fairway, it could be the slope of the fairway, the undulations, and stuff like that. In the second branch, we're kind of looking at that in terms of what is going on in our world, what is going on in our environment, what is going on with respect to what we have encountered in our realm of reality. What are the characteristics and the object and characteristics of our model of reality? And so the society is, in fact, an important aspect here. Do we live in a healthy society, or do we live in a sick society? If we live in the healthy society, and we have a reason to believe that that is in fact true, we can justify that assertion very comfortably, and then we can move on to the third branch in the truth algorithm. If in fact we do not have enough information, or if we believe that we do not live in a healthy society, then we have to go to, is it sick? And why is it sick? What are the characteristics of its disease? This nice piece by the Academy of Idea folks, and I would recommend their stuff to anybody. Their idea is that the mind can be as sick as the body, and we have sickness of the mind. And I think that is what's going on right now, affecting us in this world at the current time, in our world, in our society, in our country at the present time. We are trying to stamp out some kind of sickness of the body, which we have a name for, term for, which is COVID-19. We're trying to deal with that sickness, that malady. But in the process of dealing with that bodily sickness, we are becoming less healthy in our mind aspects of our existence. Our minds are becoming sick. We have now reached a point where we are experiencing the sickness of the mind, which is becoming first and foremost in our lives. We have a whole bunch of things that are being offered to us, lots of propositions and assertions, which, as it turns out, may not or are not true. Okay? Keep that in mind. These assertions and these propositions and these positions may not or are not, in fact, true. They are untrue. They are false. We could also say that they are misleadingly deceptive. I like the term deception. Those kinds of things. All right, so, yes, we have now encountered the sickness of the mind. So this is a great piece from the Academy of Ideas. I am coming up on the end of the show, another Throttle Up Radio show. I want to close by saying that you can, of course, find our podcast on our website, throttleupradio.com, as well as iTunes. I would recommend either one. Go to the website. We have other things that are going to be posted there, and we'll have some other aspects of the truth algorithm. My book, Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook, of course, it is a handbook, and so that's available all over. It's also available in ebook format on Kindle. We have another book project, which I will discuss in some future shows, kind of an exciting project that we are now involved with, and I think you'll find it a great book as well. All right, so I am at the end. The counter is showing. My clock is showing that I'm the end of another show, and we will see you all next week.